Welcome to the Rooney Report. Today we have with us Mr. Joseph Scheidler. Joe, thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure.
I'm glad to have you here. Joe, I know you've done a lot of work for the pro-life movement, and Patrick Buchanan years ago said that you were the Green Beret of the pro-life movement, and I think, to me, you're more like the general of the freedom of speech movement.
I do speak out a little bit.
Yeah. So we're going to do two programs. And this first program, let's just start out, you know, years ago, I'm sure your parents instilled within you the importance of respecting human life. I mean, let's start with that.
Well, the big thing in our family was a new baby. That was, we only had six, but our mom lost a couple. But that was a big thing, when mom was pregnant, to come home and find a little boy or a little girl. And I've always had a soft place in my heart for children. Mm-hmm. And part of that might spring from the fact that I remember the Lindbergh kidnapping, and the baby actually was killed in the process of the kidnapping. I think the kidnapper dropped the baby, and it was buried very close to their home. But they went ahead and made money, got a lot of money ransom for a dead baby. And so I've always worried about children. I got worried about my little brother and sister. They might be kidnapped, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know they just took rich people, kids. But I've had that soft spot. And whenever there would be an accident or a plane crash or anything, I'd always try to find out if there were children or babies on board. So that's been in my thinking. The value of the child, of the human life.
From a very young age, you had that soft spot.
And of course, we knew from our Catholic education and so on that abortion was a terrible sin. It was it's one of the few excommunicable sins. Mm-hmm. And in the early days, you had, if a person confessed an abortion, they couldn't get absolution until the priest had contacted Rome for permission, and then they. As abortions increase, that to drop down to the bishop, and then finally every priest has the right to assume permission and give absolution. But it's a terrible sin, and abortion is a killing of human life at any time, and because human life begins at conception. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows this. It's scientifically proven, and it's obvious that if you have an abortion, you're killing your child. It's almost worse than these random shootings that we have, because terrible as those are, and senseless and evil, a woman having an abortion is killing her own child, or the boyfriend is forcing her to kill their child.
Mother Teresa, now Saint Teresa of Calcutta, she spoke on that, and how here in the U.S. we don't have the financial poverty that is found in other parts of the world, but our spiritual poverty is really awful.
It's dying. In a lot of cases, it's just what you want to do. Happiness. And, you know, if you're happy, that's okay. That's how we got these crazy things like same-sex marriage. It's an abomination, you know.
The thing is, though, I think with any, for instance, with abortion, when you're taking the innocent life of a human being, that does not lead to happiness. I mean, at some point, some women, 20, 30 years down the road, they regret that abortion, and then they struggle with it. So, and also with abortion, even if you don't believe in God, it's still wrong, and it affects the entire society, because once you cheapen life at any stage, then, you know, people just don't respect human life as, you know, in other cases.
Well, you take your ancient physicians, the Hippocratic Oath and the Oath of Maimonides, and they all say that I will not give a pessary to cause an abortion. Mm-hmm. They knew that abortion was not a medical process that was allowed. And the ancient doctors took that oath, and they took it right up until just recently in this country, then they dropped that part out. We used to go to the medical gatherings for the new classes and for the graduates, and we would copy their program, but But we would put those things back in. There are two references mm-hmm. to abortion. We'd put them
back in.
I saw
that in your book, yeah.
And so when they would be reading them, the programs looked the same. We got a copy of their program without the mm-hmm. oath completed, and then we put out one that looked just like it. And then when they would come to that part, it would all get garbled because mm-hmm. some would be reading the true oath and others would be using the one with omitted text. So the idea was that for centuries and centuries, the doctor himself mm-hmm. swore not to perform an abortion.
Right.
And now who does them?
To uphold life.
Right.
You and I both have something in common with the abortion issue. Before Roe v. Wade and Doe versus Bolton, I was probably about 10 years old, and my mother, you know, was talking to one of her friends, and they had this photo of a child from New York, I think, and, you know, you could see the aborted baby, and it really, you know, ingrained, you know, it kind of seared that image in my mind. And,
right.
And it wasn't until, you know, after college I became more active, but that memory, and as you write in your book, you were really taken aback when you saw a picture of some aborted children from Canada, right?
Right. We had, it was a Saturday afternoon, and I wanted to stay home and watch the Notre Dame game, but my wife had promised a friend that we would go to a rally in the Federal Plaza. So we took those three little boys and went down there, and one of the first things that happened as we walked toward the plaza, they handed us Life and Death. The brochure that was put out by the Wilkies, Jack Wilkie, mm-hmm. Doctor, very early in pro-life. Mm-hmm. And on the back of it was the picture of the babies from the Canadian hospital. They were in a black plastic bag. They were fully formed little mm-hmm. human babies. And one of the babies actually looked like my son Eric's baby picture. Mm-hmm. And it struck me, I mean, the picture was horrible. And I immediately thought, that can't be. You know, I'd read about abortion, I knew about abortion, but I had not seen pictures. Mm-hmm. So I really paid attention to the talks. Henry Hyde was speaking, and we had, I just became obsessed with the idea that you could kill babies, throw them into garbage. Mm-hmm. And so that was in November of 1972, and of course, they were trying to pass laws in different states, but we didn't really know about Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton. We just weren't paying that much attention.
Right,
but
yeah.
When the decision came down in January of 1973, I lost interest in my account as an account executive for a PR firm in Chicago, and my boss noticed that mm-hmm. I was just reading about abortion and going out to Illinois Right to Life, which had an office in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so he called me one day and just suggested that maybe I make abortion my mission. Mm-hmm. And of course I said, well, how do you make a living?
Right, yeah, that's a tough
call. Well, we'll keep you on part salary mm-hmm. until your baby is born, because he had really good insurance for pregnancy, so the and delivery. So they kept me on, and then I started getting ready to go out and do everything I could to stop abortion.
So that took a big leap of faith, right? I mean, there's not many people who are willing to do that. I mean, you had to have some sort of calling, or you felt that this is what you need to do to fight the battle, so to speak.
Well, as I say, Father Mark said it was a calling mm-hmm. when some of us stayed after one of his talks and talked to him more about it, because he had been fighting abortion in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And so he said it's a calling, and I thought it must be, because a lot of people just weren't that, you know, the Supreme Court of ruling, they were Supreme Court of the land, it must be somewhere in the Constitution, mm-hmm. and they accepted it. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't, it wasn't there.
Right.
And the Justice White himself said it was an exercise of raw judicial power without any precedent. It's not in the Constitution.
And we know now that both Norma McCorvey and Roe v. Wade and Sandra Canton?
Cano.
Both of them didn't have an abortion, and they both lied and eventually became pro-life.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they were good friends. Norma McCorvey was actually, she looked for an abortion, but she couldn't get one, and so she just had the baby, little girl. Sandra Canard was just trying to get her children out of foster care, and they were used. They were used in these two cases that gave us abortion on demand, and they regretted that terribly. They both became good friends, and we had them in to talk, and I spent time with them, and they were suffering a great deal.
Yeah, and that case, you know, they base it on a penumbra, which is the shadow of a shadow. I mean, it's such a stretch to do that. And here in Minnesota, there's a case called Doe versus Gomez. An attorney friend of mine had done a lot of research on that. And as far as we know, there were no known plaintiffs. They had no discovery. And yet it went through. One of the women said the same day she was giving her testimony, she was having her abortion. So it was sloppy, but yet for ideological reasons, it went through.
Yeah, we've had cases in Illinois like that, and they twist the law. You know, actually, we've gotten away from the natural law on which our whole government is based. You know, we're under God. We're guaranteed the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And they knew what that meant. Mm-hmm. And the early states had laws against abortion, even against contraception.
Now, I think, Joe, that there are some real promising things to look forward to, in that a lot of the younger people are more pro-life than older generations. So I see that as very encouraging. And the current president at this time has done a lot for the pro-life movement. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it was a real surprise when Trump won, and I thought all through the campaign he would be dropping the next one to drop out, but he made it, and there was a kind of a euphoria in the pro-life movement. For one thing, we didn't have Hillary, who would have been terrible on our case, and was. But Trump, despite his idiosyncrasies and things that people make fun of and so on and want him impeached, he won, and he's been very good to the pro-life movement. I read a document the other day that had 30 or 40 positives, you know, like cutting off the funding in the Mexico City agreement and the trying to defund Planned Parenthood and putting people like Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. And having people working for him who are very pro-life, giving us a list of judges that he would appoint, and he's appointed a lot of judges around the country, and are pro-life. So it's been a very positive thing for the pro-life movement. He's trying to defund Planned Parenthood and give us religious freedom, cut off this nonsense that they're...
Have you met him yet, sir?
Trump? No, I haven't. I
never met. You did meet Donald Reagan and several other leaders.
Yeah, we had meetings with Reagan, and we've had, I met some saintly people. Mother Teresa of Calcutta was a good friend one time. She was giving a talk, and nobody could see her behind the podium. So I was trying to sell my book, Clothes, 99 Ways to Stop Abortion. And I had a whole box of them. So I said, Mother, stand back. And I pushed the box there, and she stood up on it. And people cheered because they could see her now. And I said later, when she became a saint, we had a second-class relic in that box, all those books, relics.
Now, in your book, you were a little, you pushed the envelope, so to speak, right? And at one of the Clinton rallies, you actually, I don't know if it was you or your people, got up on stage and spelled out Clinton and then equals, right?
We weren't on the stage at one. It was an outdoor thing. But we had large letters, and they spelled out Clinton. And people we'd say, give me a C, and spell it out. And then when you got to the end of it, we had an equals sign. And then we flipped the signs over, and it said abortion. And, of course, that shocked the people because most of them were there for Clinton. Mm-hmm. We did this, that same thing.
And you were escorted out, probably.
Oh, yeah, we were always escorted out. We're used to being escorted out. But we got in, and we would do that even when Reagan came through Chicago. We were down on the area where he landed, and we had O'Connor. He was he had selected Sandra Day O'Connor for the Supreme Court, and she had a bad record on abortion. So we did use those numbers, and then in my book, Closed, I show how to put those together and use them and flip them over and the whole thing to get the message across.
And while you're getting the message across, I think people who don't understand, you know, we talked about this earlier in the program, that you really have a heart for children, and you know, you don't hate Clinton, you don't hate these other people, but you want to try and help the most defenseless, and you'll do that, you know, as best you can without being violent or taking any, you know, measures like that.
Yeah, one of the chapters in my book is why violence won't work. I'm totally against violence, even though I've been charged with it, and they, the National Organization for Women put out a film called The Holy Terror, and it's about me being behind the burning of clinics and bombing and so on, which is certainly not true. But it came up during our trial, and they had people come in and just lie through their teeth about how violent we were at the clinics and so on. And we weren't able to prove or disprove these things because they didn't give their names. And we were in the middle of the trial, but after the trial, we were able to check out all of their accusations, all of them false. But we were found guilty of racketeering. So we had to go to the Supreme Court all the way through the other courts, and then the Supreme Court ruled in our favor, 8-1. And then when we came back down, they didn't accept the decision of the Supreme Court. They said that there were two or three predicate acts that were missing. Well, they had 100 and some, and they didn't say what they were. But we had to go back to the Supreme Court through the whole process and get exonerated unanimously that time. So eventually we got a little money from the National Organization for Women. Not much, but it the case lasted all those years and was very expensive.
And you really had a lot on the line. I mean, you had to put your house up, you know, as for the bail, and it had to be quite a struggle.
Yeah, and the bond was something like $250,000, and so we had our house appraised, and we came out with that, and the judge fortunately accepted the house. The, the abortionists wanted money, but we couldn't come up with the $250,000. So for a number of years, we did not own our house.
Wow.
It was actually owned by the National Organization for Women, but we could still live there.
When I was reading in your book, there was one clinic you went to where they did abortions, and you put on your business card, "Sorry I missed you, I'll be back." And during the trial, that person made it sound like that was a death threat.
Oh, yeah. "Sorry I missed," hitting you, you know, shooting you. And that's how it was interpreted. It was a simple card, "Sorry I missed you. I went to the clinic. I wanted to talk to the people. They weren't there yet." And so I named one of the chapters that, "Sorry I missed you." Because we missed them. We missed so many people that we need to talk to. And I would often go into the clinic and try to talk to the people there. And I would have dinner with the abortionists. And we had a number of doctors that converted, came over to our side: Tony Levitino, Mark Arthur Hill, Bernard Nathanson, and so on. And we had them all come to Chicago, and we did 6 conferences with former abortionists, and we filmed them, meet the abortion providers, and abortion the inside story. People can get it on our website, those films, besides other films that we've made about abortion. And the efforts you have to make to go out on the streets, to go to the clinics, to talk to the doctors, to get on as many radio and TV shows as you can. And that was one thing that sort of consoled me about the case, Now versus Schneider. We got a lot of
publicity,
coverage, and it's now in the law books and so on. So it was almost a positive thing. And then the fact that we finally won with Tom Brekka, who was our
Thomas
attorney.
Thomas More Society.
Thomas More Society, and that actually our case started the Thomas More Society, and now they have hundreds of cases all over the country, and they're winning many, many of them. They have David DeLeiden's case and some others that are very important. And Tom's a great guy, but when I first met him, he was so low-key and sort of mumbly, and I thought, I need a dynamic lawyer.
Right.
But Tom mumbled that I win cases.
And you were happy, yeah.
And that was it, and he did.
Yeah,
it took a while, but he won the case, and then
it
they
took, what, 28 years, was it?
He says 28. I say 26, but he says 28.
Oh, because of the final appeals at the end.
Right,
yeah,
and all that. But that's a long time to be in court.
That is, yeah.
And my wife now, Anne, is the chairman of the Thomas More Society Board of Directors and very active with them.
Good.
So, and they're doing wonderful work.
Great.
We just had a big banquet with Thomas More and Pro-Life Action League combined. And it was, Tom and I were the speakers.
Oh, good.
We thought, why bring in somebody else? You know, we've heard all their talks.
Right.
So we just had an interlocutor, and Tom and I, they asked questions. And,
sure.
And people said they really enjoyed it.
Good, good. Now, during the court case, another thing that I thought was interesting that Tom was helping you on is you were at a pro-life gathering of some pro-life leaders, and the guy who had the sign, and he said something about welcome pro-lifers, and then at the very end in your book, the guy said he was going to put, have a ball, but he didn't have another extra L.
Right.
So instead of ball, he put blast. Yeah. And that was
That became a very
a hot
important
item, yeah.
Very important
no pun
to
intended.
The case.
Yeah.
That was Jerry Horn. He and Norm Stone had a sort of a halfway house up in Appleton, Wisconsin. And they had, recovering drinkers and drug takers and women who were pregnant. And it was just a very, very fine old motel, which they ran very well. And Jerry was the cook, but they asked him to go out and welcome us. We were having our national convention, Pro-Life Action Network. And that is true. They had a box of these letters left over, and his plan was have a ball. But without that extra L, and he had an S, he just said, have a blast, didn't think much of it.
Right.
One of the women went to him and said, you think that might give the wrong idea? And he said, if you want to change it, change it. But he said, I'm busy. He was cooking for this large mob.
Yeah. Who would have ever thought?
That was very, very important photograph that they
used.
They used, and they really, it was almost critical to the case because they were able to say that meant we were planning violence.
Which you weren't.
Not at all. Have a blast.
Yeah.
When Jack Wilkie was on in the dock for, answering questions, they showed him the picture. They blew it up, put it on a great big screen, and he said, well, they're having a party.
Yeah.
You call
it
a blast.
Yeah.
Have a blast.
I wouldn't
is a
think
common,
of that
common phrase.
Otherwise, yeah. Now, because of your involvement, you did meet some, and I don't think you and I would call them pro-life, but they went further than they should have. They were misdirected, and they did take violence, which, we are totally against. And part of the case was trying to tie you into that.
Yes, that was a very important part of the case, because I knew these people. I knew them from just being in pro-life, John Brockoff, and I could name a whole bunch, but they were good friends. They were pro-life. They were pretty low-key. I mean, they were out on the streets, and they were doing the same things we were with the pictures and with the trying to convert the abortionists. But these particular individuals reached the point where if you had blown up Auschwitz or Buchenwald, would that have been such a terrible thing, if nobody got hurt? And they were very careful about that nobody was around, but still, you don't do that. And we got blamed for that.
Yeah, which you shouldn't have. Yeah.
Well, they said I was the ringleader, sort of. And I've met with some of these people afterwards, and they've spent time in jail, and they are still good pro-lifers. They're not doing violence anymore.
Right, yeah.
But I did actually meet with some of them and showed them the film and told them that this can't, you can't do this.
And I think in this case, it helps the other side more than anything.
Oh,
I mean, it gives them, that was key in the lawsuit you were involved with.
Right. Yeah. It gives them evidence, real evidence, that there is violence. And then all they have to do is take statements like, sorry, I missed you, and have a blast, attach that to me, and say, he's behind it.
Yeah. Well, Joe, we're going to do another program after this one, and then we can talk a little bit more about, your case. Any closing comments for people who are just watching this program?
Well, I just tell people to do something pro-life every day. Either go out to your local clinic and try to talk to the women going in, or meet with the doctor, or do something. If you can't do anything overt like that, say a prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Because the motto we use in the Pro-Life Action League is a Benedictine motto, ora et labora, to pray and to work. They're both important, but the prayer is the most important because it brings us closer to God.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Good. Well, thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. We'll be back again next week with the Rooney Report.
We provide the legal defense to the people who really are the last line of defense to these women and these babies. That's why Life Legal does what they do, because someone like Father James Linton isn't going to be able to hire a huge firm and pay thousands of dollars to litigate a criminal case, but Life Legal is able to do that because of the support of our donors and that people find what we do to be important.